Okay, if I got your attention, then let me give you a warm-up question. Make sure that you're focused and your brain is flowing. It's an interesting, mind-bending sort of question, okay? So you ready?
Yeah.
All right, here you go. When you don't know what to do, how do you decide what to do? Just think about it for 8 seconds. When you don't know what to do, how do you decide what to do? It's open-ended. All right, somebody tell me. When you don't know what to do, how do you decide what to do? Pray, that's good. I mean, somebody had to say that because a lot of us are Christians here, and so, you know, we need to say pray. All right, what else? When you don't know what to do, how do you decide what to do? What was that?
Go out and eat.
Go out and eat, which is like praying, but more caloric. Go out and eat. Give it some space. Give it some. Sure, I get that. What else? You don't know what to do. How do you decide what to do? Yeah, Dave. You look at what other people are doing and you follow them. Now, you look at what other smart people are doing and you follow them. I think that's what you meant. That was implied. Look what Jordan is doing. That's all right. Good. You may move up. Yeah. Excellent. All right. That's good. That's good. What else? We got some more of these are good. When you don't know what to do, how do you decide what to do? Rod?
I call my mom.
You call your mom. I love this. How old are you, man? You're still calling mom. That's the way to go. Yeah, mom knows. That's good. That's good. All right. Because mom is, of course, the best person to ask. All right. You got some more? GG. You choose the option that has eternal value. All right, there you go. That's good. That's what you'd expect from G. You figure out, well, which one is the most valuable and what makes the thing valuable, the thing that has eternal fruitfulness, you know. Life is, there's limited resources, limited time, so focus on eternity as much as possible. Why don't you get up and preach? That's better. That was one. Yeah, Brian, what you got? Okay, Brian has a system, which if you know Brian, it's like he pauses. That's good. You take a breath. That's not gonna hurt. Depending on the anxiety level, you might give it more time, right? Because you have to like calm. You have to make sure that your head is clear, and then you can consult wise people and experts and stuff like that. Yeah, whose hand was it? Mia. It's the opposite of that. That's good. That's good. That's good. Because who cares about Brian?
I would just, do something and then figure out if it was the wrong thing to do.
Ah. Trial and error. I love that. Do something and then see if it worked. And if it didn't work, step two.
Try something else.
Do something else. All right. I like that a lot. Derek. All right. This is going to be the best one. This is the last one. Derek. You stress about it unnecessarily and then sleep on it. Come on. Come on. How many? And if you stress well enough, then you can just collapse and just have this emotional exhaustion. And yeah, it's fantastic. All right, so we know what to do. I really don't need to preach anymore. We're in the sermon series on the story of the book of Exodus, which is the story of the Israelites getting out of slavery and moving toward the promised land. We've decided that really it's not so much a book about getting people out of slavery. It's a book about getting slavery out of people. It's relatively easy to get people out of slavery, relatively hard to get the slavery out of people. And this is a story about how God goes about doing that, which a group of people who had been in slavery for over 4 centuries, it had kind of become their whole culture, their whole identity. We started the series at the end, which is the Israelites get to the Jordan River, the boundary to the promised land. They see that there are giants in the land, and they chicken out, turn tail, and run. And so one of the things we need to know going in is that ultimately, if you want to be a free individual in God, you're going to develop the ability to go beast mode. You're going to have to just like, well, I don't care. Let's go get us a giant, you know. You're going to have to put down your head and charge ahead. And if you lack that beast mode ability, you're going to get stuck in life eventually. And so that's how we started. That kind of like set the standard for us. And then we went back and started at the beginning. One of the first things that God does to the Israelites is he makes their slavery uncomfortable, because we get comfortable in the gray area. We can cope with anything. And so God will often come along when he wants to free you in life, and he will ruin things that are going on in order to get you to change. And that's just part of the process. Then we talked about the lure of reasonable compromises, the temptation of reasonable compromises, because when God starts doing miracles of deliverance in Egypt, the 10 plagues, Pharaoh starts offering the Israelites compromise solutions. Oh, you want to go into the wilderness to do a worship retreat? How about you stay in Egypt and do a worship retreat, and that way I know I can still control you if push comes to shove. And Pharaoh, you know, not a vacation, but a staycation. And the enemy often offers us reasonable sounding compromises. And if you want to be an actual free, powerful individual in the world, you have to learn to recognize that reasonable compromises are often traps. Don't compromise with the enemy. He's the enemy. What's the proper thing to do to the enemy? Well, you know, probably fight him. We talked about the tyranny of fear, because that's the thing that controls us mostly in the world. We talked about the tyranny of need. And that's another thing that controls us. You know, most of us in the world make money our lord, and it determines the shape of our life, where we live, what we do, where we go, and stuff like that. We talked about how we need the ability to escape victim mentality, which is super common in the world. And today, we're going to talk about the difference between deliverance and combat, between getting delivered by God and fighting your way free, which sounds similar, but ends up being hugely different in terms of developing the spirit of a people, of a person. And specifically, we're going to talk about dealing with, fighting back against crises that we didn't see coming, sneak attacks, right? When life sort of attacks us out of nowhere, what do we do in that moment? What happens when you learn that the world is actually a dangerous place? Do you shrink back from the world? Do you want somebody to come and take care of you? A mommy tyrant? Not that there's anything wrong with calling mom to get good advice. Do we get combative? Do we develop fighting spirit? So that's the general theme. You ever met someone who got the fight knocked out of him in life? You know, I think it happens all the time. There's a lot of stories in Exodus and in the Bible about restoration of a fighting spirit. And in my ministry of counseling individuals or discipling individuals, this is something I have to focus on a lot. In fact, some of you will know this. What's my favorite counseling phrase of all time?
Get over it.
Get over it. That's a good one. Anybody in the Young Adults Leadership Academy should know this, but what is it? Let's do this. It's the one that we started, because it focuses you on action, fight, and faith is trying, and all that stuff. I mean, it's a huge part of who I am and how I move through the world, is this idea of fighting spirit. But it's hard. I was thinking this week of an old friend of mine. We'll call her Mary. And the definitive event in Mary's life is that she got into a car accident. And it was, you know, relatively serious, totaled the car. And she was injured to a degree that she had to get hospitalized. Right? It was never a question of, whether she was going to live or not, you know, but she needed some rehab and stuff like that. It kind of affected her neck and, you know, a little concussion and stuff like that. And that can be a little bit involved. So she had to undergo rehab and whatnot. And, you know, and it took some months to kind of get over that. Okay. That's traumatic. And I got to know her about that time, about that time of her life as she was going through, walking out of it, pray for healing and stuff like that, and things seemed to be going okay. And then she got stuck in it. You know, like she realized that the world was a very dangerous place, and it began to affect everything about her. You know, at first you're like, well, you know, I'm recovering. My body is recovering from injury. You know, maybe I can't go to church as much. Maybe I can't, you know, commit to being in places. But that just became a lifestyle. We're 20 years after the fact, and she still cannot pre-commit to show up anywhere. She consults with her doctor to ask him if it's okay for her to take vacations, because you never know, it might be too stressful. At this point, there's really nothing wrong with her physically, but she's got a haunted look in her eyes. And it's sort of iconic for me for this mentality that people fall into sometimes when they realize that the world is a dangerous place. And it's not quite victim mentality. I call it prey mentality. Can you ever see in somebody's eyes that they look like a prey animal? Right? They look like a, what would be a prey animal here? We really don't have them on land in Hawaii, but like, you know, a rabbit creeping out of the edge of the forest, you know. Everything about a rabbit's mannerism is designed to compensate for hawks. You know, it's like, the world is a really dangerous place. The world is, and it's like, this is the thing that I need to pass on to my children. This is the defining characteristic of life on earth. You think of yourself as a prey animal. It's caution to the point of being controlled. And we've talked a lot about things that control us. And you need freedom from overcaution. You need freedom from prey mentality. If you can't fight back, you'll be controlled in life. And you can write that down. If you can't fight back, you'll be controlled in life. Fight back against what? Well, I mean, you know, it almost doesn't matter. Whatever danger, whatever thing that presses you, if you can't fight back, you're going to be controlled in life. I've shared this story before, I think, within the past year. I used to do a lot of martial arts, and I helped run this dojo, this karate dojo, when I got to be senior enough in it. And when somebody new would join the dojo, we were kind of impatient. Be like, well, let's see if they're going to last. So one of the senior brown belts or a black belt would be tasked to kind of spar with this person just to kind of introduce them to, like, oh, yeah, you know, this is punch, this is dodging and stuff like that. And our assignment was, with every newbie who came in the course of the first lesson, we would hit the person. That was the assignment. Now, we wouldn't hurt the person, but we just, you know, shock them a little bit. And then you would take a step back and you would gauge their reaction. We never hurt a single person the entire time that we did this, but a ton of people quit after that lesson because there's a shock to getting hit, you know? And it's like, oh, you came to a fighting skills gymnasium and you're shocked at getting hit. But people don't realize that they can't take a punch and fight back. They want to learn to fight, but they don't really want to go through the pain of fighting back. You know what I'm saying? People can't get over the shock of it. They get, you know, they get offended. And that ends up being kind of the key. Are you going to get combative or are you going to get offended and outraged and run? That tends to be a watershed reaction moment in our lives. And we were just kind of looking to people who are willing to be combative. It's like, oh, okay. Like, I don't care about your skill set. But if you're willing to be combative, we can train you. If you're not, you're wasting everybody's time, you know, because we're a karate dojo. We're not, you know, we can't do therapy. Go to church. And, you know, which was often my pitch. I took some of them to church, actually. It ended up being a very evangelistic place for me. So combativeness is really what we're talking about. And that's kind of the setup to our passage, which this week is from Exodus chapter 17. We talked previously before Easter about the water from the rock story. God had taken the Israelites to a place where they had no rock. Moses strikes the rock, water miraculously poured from the rock. God has proven himself a deliverer. He's proven himself a provider. They've had all of these miracle experiences with God. Early in the story, we see God direct the Israelites to travel across what is the kind of the Saudi Arabian wilderness, what today is the Arabian Peninsula, and move them away from potential attackers, like he moved them away from the Philistines and stuff like that. But this is the story when they do get attacked. Picking it up in verse 8, I'm going to read Exodus 17, 8 through 16. You can follow along in your Bibles, or you can follow along on the big board. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. This is sort of the southern Arabian Peninsula. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Let me just interject here that this isn't the first place that this is mentioned. In Deuteronomy, it's mentioned again. It was a signal event in the history of the early Israelites, the early Promised Land Israelites. They didn't just attack the Israelites at Rephidim. It was a sneak attack. What they did is they snuck up and attacked the mass of Israelites from the rear where the baggage was, because they wanted to steal all the treasures they had taken from Egypt. And so essentially they attacked the people who are with the baggage, which would have been, by convention, the elderly, women, and children. So it was that kind of attack. It was a surprise attack out of nowhere. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." We've come to know this staff in the story. So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur, his brother and brother-in-law, held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. When the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." I'm going to completely wipe out that tribe. Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "For hands were lifted up to the throne of God, and the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." Interesting story. This is a place where you start to get really offended, because it starts looking, you know, kind of violent. I mean, it's one thing if the Egyptians were drowned, but this was like swords and stuff. Fighting, the ability to do it, ends up being a big deal in the story. Again, it was a very dastardly attack. It's worse if you know that the Amalekites were actually descendants of Esau. Esau was the brother of Jacob. Jacob was the father of the Israelite nation. They were cousins, essentially. They were close cousins. And the Amalekites lived in the Negev, in sort of what is southern Israel today, around the Gaza Strip, and it's been in the news a lot. And Goshen, where the Israelites were in slavery, was northern Egypt. So they were basically neighbors the last 400 years. And when the Israelites escaped Egypt, the Amalekites would have obviously gotten the news, and they would have known that the Israelites took a lot of Egyptian treasure with them, right? And so they went after the treasure ultimately. They did not attack the Israelites right then and there. They waited until the Israelites traveled like 100 miles down the coast and then came at them out of nowhere so that it was totally sneaky. They waited until the Israelites walked into a dark alley and then they jumped on them from behind, essentially, and attacked them where they were weak. Super dastardly. It's like getting mugged by your cousin, you know, super dastardly, super violent. And then they would have hit, taken the treasure, and then kind of run. That would have been their model. And this really makes God angry for all sorts of reasons. But he wants the Israelites to know he is angry for them. But he doesn't fight for them. It was like he doesn't send a plague on the Amalekites or something like that. In fact, as far as we can tell in the story, God gives the Israelites no orders until after the battle is over. And this is the first time in the story of the book of Exodus where Moses just takes action. He just responds. It's kind of like God saying, well, show me what you've learned. It's that sort of deal. So in that, I find that this story is the most relatable one we've read so far in the book of Exodus. It's kind of like you're going through life, you get sideswiped by some crisis or disaster in life, and you have to figure out what to do. God has not given you a blueprint for success. You just have to do something. You don't know what to do. How do you decide what to do? It's kind of this moment. And we see Moses kind of improvises here. You know, he doesn't just follow orders. He takes action, which to me feels a little bit like a development. It feels like his leadership is developing. It feels like their spirit is developing. He decides to take action. So that's a first. And I feel like it's a watershed moment. Another first is this is the first time in the story that this guy Joshua gets mentioned. And he becomes the leader of Israel after Moses. He inherits Moses' mantle, so to speak. And the future record, I mean, Joshua eventually gets his own book. But the future stories, the stories that follow this one, tell us what kind of character Joshua had. But you can kind of tell by this story what kind of character Joshua had. It's like, look, we're a nation of slaves. We need to fight back. Moses decides, who do I got? I got Joshua. And it just kind of tells you what you need to know about this guy. Now, he had been a slave, but Moses is like, and yet he's exactly the guy that's going to lead the counterattack. How? Well, I mean, obviously he had attitude. Right, he was the kind of guy who's like, look, I know you've never done this before. Here's a sword, sick him. He was that kind of guy. Love him. Just love him. He ends up being a steady rock. Because if you want to be faithful, you have to learn how to fight. If you don't know how to fight, you're going to be very unsteady. So we were talking about this story at my Ohana group on Wednesday. And of course, the topic of Pearl Harbor came up, right? Because that's the most famous sneak attack in our collective history. The dust settles, and what's the first thing that you want to do? Well, it depends. You know, but that story is famous because we decided to enter a world war and change the course of history as a result. There's some sense that this changed the course of history of the Israelites. Question. How did Moses decide what to do when he didn't have direct orders about what to do? What does he do? What do you notice in the story? Well, what I notice is that Moses just picked up some things that he did know how to do. It's like, oh, we have a crisis. Oh, we're facing violence and death. Well, I got the staff. That's good. I know this staff is good. I've like parted a sea with it. I've turned it into a snake. Like there's all sorts of really cool things I've done with it. So I'm taking the staff because that's powerful. And what else? And the thing about raising hands was how they prayed in that culture. So this is basically Moses takes his badge of authority. He goes to a hilltop and he prays. That's kind of what's going on. And as long as he was active in that, the army won. And when he got tired of doing his bit, the army lost. It was an army. It was probably a raiding party. It was probably like maybe a couple hundred guys or something like that. But he was on a hilltop so he could see if it was working. Because he did something, but he might need to try something else if it didn't work, right? So he put himself in a real-time data collection position. It has all the earmarks of an improvised but kind of reasonable type solution. I don't know if he knew it was going to work, but you could understand why he thought it was an okay thing to try. It's like, okay, this is what I think I'm going to do. It's like, I'm going to go with Joshua. I think he's my best bet. Joshua, you find some guys, you know, because guys like Joshua always know guys like Joshua, right? And this is kind of the story. It's the difference between I know what to do and I know the sort of thing to do. And that's where we live, is it not? We live right there between I know what to do and I know the sort of thing to do. And if you're the kind of person that gets paralyzed in the gap, you're never going to be free. That's what this story is about. That's what this story is about. Okay, so let's do this then. That's what this story is about. Faith means trying, not waiting around. That's what this story is about. Are you feeling it? You feeling the spirit of it? God is with us, so let's try something. He's got our back. You know, that's kind of the attitude. And that's where a lot of us live, is it not? If you live in a place where I'm going to wait to see what God does, and, you know, and then he's going to tell me when the coast is clear, then, I don't know, your life stinks. But you're certainly not a free, powerful person either. Kind of what the story is about. Free people don't just receive deliverance. They also fight back. Truism. There's sort of an empowerment level up going on in this story. They don't just obey, although obedience is hugely important. They learn what to do. They don't just obey, they learn what to do. Right? So God doesn't need to be there as director in every event of their life. They've become strong individuals. They're not just dependent children. They've become, you know, adults in their own right. And there's a lot of adulting in this story, I think. Individuation, which I really like. We also see in this story God's principle of righteous anger, which is a great principle, people, and one that I think releases a lot of maturity and freedom in life. You know what righteous anger is? Well, it's anger. You know, it's righteous anger. It sounds good, anger, but righteous anger is a galvanizing emotion. You know what the word emotion means, by the way? Emotion is a motion, that which gives us motion. That's what an emotion is. Sometimes you have emotions that give you paralysis. Those are bad emotions. Good emotions give you movement. And righteous anger. Anger is a very emotive emotion, right? It galvanizes you. It's supposed to force you forward into something productive, constructive. And righteous anger pushes you in a good direction. But you have to let yourself be righteously angry. And a lot of us have, you know, I have a short temper, but some of us have anger intolerance. Like you could have errors on both sides, but you need to develop a skill for righteous anger. Righteous anger is not this. Righteous anger, the spirit of righteous anger, is not the spirit of injured complaint. It's different, right? You can get offended, you can get outraged, you can get hit in the jojo and decide that you don't want to learn to fight, but that's not right. That's anger, but it's not emotive righteous anger. It doesn't propel you forward, it propels you back, right? So righteous anger is not injured complaint. In our culture, I think we sometimes substitute offense and outrage for righteous anger. And the difference is offense and outrage beg for safety, and righteous anger makes you fight. It's a little bit different, Not that they're not time to be, you know, offended, but righteous anger is willing to face danger. And that's why it's important. If you're not willing to face danger, then you have to do something else. You have to either spend a life cowering, or you have to go get some big boss to always do your fighting for you. So all of that is folding in into the story. You know, this idea of fighting is a hugely important thing. In the story, it's a hugely important thing in my life. I mean, I could talk about it for hours and hours, but I won't. I'm going to start wrapping up the sermon now. But you've probably heard me talk about it before. God has just gone way out of his way in my life to teach me how to fight. I was thinking of this story from my childhood. I remember sharing this years ago in a Blue Water sermon. I was between 5 and 6 years old. And, you know, my childhood was a little bit unstable. We were hunted by the police for a while, and we sort of washed up in this little town in Oregon. And I remember I was trying to intentionally learn how to make friends because I had lived underground a lot. And so I was hanging out with some people my age on the streets, this dead-end street where I lived, and this kid came down the street, And I can't remember his name anymore, but he was 14 years old, and he started kind of like being the big shot. Hey, twerps, what are you guys doing? Because we were all like 6, 7 years old. And by the way, twerp was a word back then. This was in the 1970s, twerp. Look it up. And he was like, you know, basically it was just kind of showing off. And I got angry because I felt like, I want these people to be my friends, and this guy is bullying them. Like I don't like that. And so I spouted off back to him and said, "Man, leave us alone." And he's like, "What are you gonna do about it, twerp?" And I remember that moment. Like he was 14, I was like 6 years old. I was like, "I have no chance. I'm gonna kill him." And I remember standing by a ditch. So I just ran at him, and I just threw myself at him and like knocked him down into the ditch, you know. And that was the start of it. And what I remember about this fight is that it went all the way down the street. And, of course, if he really wanted to hurt me, he would have. But he was just like, get off, you know. It was that kind of thing. And so I would attack him. He would pick me up, and he'd throw me into the ditch. I'd get up, dust myself off, and I'd run at him. We went all the way down the street. And the end of the story was, like, he ran into a yard. It's like I'm a little dog chasing a German shepherd at this point. He ran into this yard up on this, like his auntie's house, up under this porch. And I ran, and I grabbed him on this porch. I didn't even know whose house it was at the time, because I was new to the neighborhood. And he picked me up, and he threw me against the door. And the door burst open. And I backwards somersaulted into this living room. I remember this moment, lying right there, looking around. And there were like 7 old ladies having a tea party. But the reason I remember, well, I mean, maybe I remember the story because I was embarrassed, but the reason I remember the story is because there was something that clicked in my spirit there that I think was really helpful to me. And it sort of, it was one way that I arrived in life, sort of arrived socially. People who won't fight, need somebody to fight for them. And then they will be controlled by that somebody. And so that's a danger. And God doesn't want you to be controlled by somebody. He wants to give you self-control. That's the difference. You know, the devil tries to control you. The Holy Spirit restores your self-control. You know, because God did not give you a spirit of fear, did he? He gave you a, what's the verse? Spirit of power, a sound mind, and self-control. Yeah, self-control. So there's a restoration here, and the restoration comes through fighting. There are lots of scriptures about it. Again, the book of Exodus is filled with it, Deuteronomy. Judges 3 is one that I always think of. When the Israelites finally get the promised land, Judges 3 tells us, and these were the tribes the Lord left in the land in order to teach future generations of Israelites the art of warfare. Like every generation needs to learn how to fight for themselves, because if you don't, you end up being controlled. Why? Because the world is a dangerous place. That's why. And so you have to develop the spirit of fighting back. People who are not willing to fight become willing to murder. That's a personal proverb that I wrote to myself a while ago. To understand things. People who are not willing to fight back become willing to murder. Because the world is a dangerous place and you got to solve things somehow. Right? So if you don't develop that sort of open warrior spirit, you have to develop a sneaky assassination spirit. Murder is fighting, but with extreme control. It's a weird way to define it, I know. But do you understand what I'm saying? There's been, I think, a spirit released in our culture in recent years in which you're just, like, you're not allowed to fight. You're like, you're not allowed to speak freely. You're not allowed to debate freely. You're not even allowed to articulate. And you're like, well, that's not so bad. I mean, it's just speech. But you wait, on the back end of that, there is a degree of control that becomes contempt. And contempt is the spirit of murder. You're willing to completely annihilate people if you have to, and the spirit gets released, and it goes dark really, really fast, really, really fast. You know, I'm a historian. That was my PhD training in political science. Like, history is filled with this. Once you start Once you lose the ability to fight openly, to debate openly, that always ends in mass murder. Always. Always. And so when you see God developing fighting spirit in people, you think, oh, well, that's violence, and violence is murder. No, no, it's anti-murder. It's the spirit that contends against murder. It's the spirit that contends against the sort of cowardly murderers that will attack you from behind and kill your elderly women and children. And that's why God is all over this story. He's like, write this down. This one gets in the book, guys. And tell Joshua about it, because he's going to be the future, because I like that guy too. He's got attitude. Write this down. Like, this is going to have serious repercussions for you and for you, Joshua. Remember this victory. Remember it. But for the Amalekites as well, because they just exhibited the exact spirit that I must eliminate in the world. And I'm going to do it by creating in you a spirit of fighting. You get it?
Yeah.
And hopefully that sort of takes some of the sting out of the more violent passages that you read in the story. That's what's going on, right? You're fighting against violence, because the world is a dangerous place. And maybe you're not prey. Maybe you can fight back. Maybe you can fight back. Now, when other people preach this passage, you've probably heard other pastors do it, they always preach it as a passage about intercessory prayer, because Moses goes up and raises his hands, and you think it's about intercessory prayer. It's like Moses doing his bit, but it's Moses doing his bit so that he can release Joshua and the guys to do their bit, right? There is an antagonism here. There's a spirit that we very nice, pleasant, prayerful Christians need to understand, that sometimes you just gotta charge the 14-year-old man. I mean, you're just gonna have to fight back. You're gonna have to learn to respond, even if God's not giving you orders. You know, you can't beg him for assurance after assurance after assurance. Sometimes you just gotta throw the frickin' punch. Turn to somebody and say, yeah, just you don't have to say frickin' if you don't want to. Just throw the punch. All right. Let's end by saying I want to point out that this story is more like the sorts of stories that we experience in our lives. Like, there are no, super great miracles here. There's no, specific great guidance from God for these people. It's just that we face a crisis, and we need to figure out something godly to do about it. And if we have a little fighting spirit, that helps. So it's a super relatable story, and therefore it's a super applicable story for many of us. And here's how I would suggest you apply it generally. Are you hard-pressed in life? Are you stuck? Has something traumatic happened to you and just sort of dazed you recently? Or, is it something, some sort of hard-pressing situation that has, restricted you for a while recently? Every mission needs a method, is another proverb that we have around Blue Water. So you have to come up with a way to handle it. You need to come up with a plan. You need to come up with a course of action. And there's a very basic lesson about the life of freedom and godliness that I want to give you. And here's the lesson. Do something. Do something. Don't do nothing. Nothing is the only thing you're not allowed to do. Do something in life. And a lot of times, like I mentioned, these hard counseling or discipleship situations, I mean, this is 80% of the game. I mean, just sort of looking in somebody's face, think, okay, let's do something. What? I don't know. Let's do this. Do something. I mean, we're smart. We've been hanging around God for a while. We know things. We have principles and options and tools. Let's just come up with something and let's do it. Well, what if God wants? God is basically with us, right? I mean, he's basically with us, and he's like a parent, right? And, parents want their kids to, grow up and be capable, and he's not going to abandon us. He's there for us. Let's just do something. Do something. God's got our back. And the biggest problem you have in life when things get scary, dangerous, disappointing, fearsome is doing nothing. That's the biggest problem you have in life. That's it. Faith means trying. You have to learn how to fight back, or you'll never, ever progress as an actual free, powerful individual. In Jesus' name, amen.